with 70 ohm hardline cable. Cable TV type, 3/4 inch diameter, 3/4 inch diameter cable, and everyone would turn their nose up against it, about it. I have probably 1,000 feet of it in use on my towers right now in my backyard, and the stuff is fantastic. And I think you've heard me say often, how do I get around the problem of 70 ohms versus 50 ohms? I put a piece of paper tape on the cable, and I write on the piece of paper tape 50 ohms, and I make sure that that part of the cable faces toward my transmitter. The transmitter doesn't know the difference, and the stuff works like a charm. In reality, you do create a 1.4 standing wave ratio with 70 ohm cable versus 50 ohm, both at the antenna end and the transmitter end. And if you want to really get that last little bit of loss out of the system, you could put a quarter wave matching transformer of 66 ohms in between the two and correct for it. I've never had to do that. So 70 ohm cable is lower in loss. The price is fantastic. You would have to pay $5 a foot if you bought brand new Andrew cable that had the equal performance of 3/4 inch hardline. And I can get you 3/4 inch hardline, 1,000 feet of it, for free. The price is right. Any further words on this, Bob? KQLIW.
Now, one more question I want to mention about the yes, about the census that can take to KQ.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, you must understand one thing. The regular PL-259 connector will not go on to the 9914 because the sensor is number 10, not number 13 like regular RG8. So you have to specify if you're going to buy, you know, get connected, that you want to use it on 9914, Dick, over.
Now, I get around that problem by machining the end of the, machining the center conductor. I literally take a file and bring it down to a smaller size so it fits into the connector. I wonder if you've done it that way, or are you more of a Cadillac person, Mel, where you just buy the right connector rather than doing machining to make the connector you got work. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, well, I did in a pinch. What I do is I stick the connector into the lathe, and I have the drill that opens it up that little bit so that it thins out the wall of the connector a little bit, but it flips right on, I think, without file sitting there with a file over.
Okay. So back to you for any further questions or comments, Bob.
So the velocity factor of 66 versus 78% on the foam, as far as longevity is saying, the straight polyethylene dielectric would be better in the long course, depending on the price, of course. Over to you, Dick.
That's part of what I said, Bob. However, foam cable for the same diameter, without a doubt, is lower in loss. As long as the outer conductor has a foil, which is a hermetic seal, not just a foil wrap, a hermetically sealed foil. In other words, a foil that has no openings in it of any kind along the length of the cable. It's okay to have an opening at the end where you chop it and put the connector on, but if everywhere else it is sealed with a hermetic seal of foil, not just a foil wrap, then foam cables are great. But to avoid any possible problems, 90-some-odd percent of all of my transmission lines, 90-some-odd percent of each individual run is hardline. And I use as little flexible cable as I can because I haven't had the good luck of some of these other guys of the flexible cables with the right kind of a foil inside to keep out the moisture. I wonder if that makes some sense. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, enough said. Thank you very much. I'll be on the side listening. W2PNJ. Thanks again, guys.
W2OS for another comment.
Okay, Bob, review OES. Bob, number two, and OES recognized. Bob, number one, when you finally settle on a cable, and when you put connectors on the end of it, you have good news, bad news, and please come back and tell us what you've done and what you found. Also, a couple years later, when you find out the cable works like a charm or it gives you trouble, please come back and tell us. OSR first, go ahead. That's Bob, number two.
Okay, I do have the part number for the correct Amphenol PL-259 to use with the flex cable with the number 10 diameter stranded wire. center conductor. It's Amphenol part number 83-, can't tell if it's I01ST-1050, also called 74868. Looks like those are the numbers. This is special connected just for that type of cable.
Okay, that's good to know. So somebody does make a PL-259 that goes on directly without doing any machining. And there's a ridiculous number of people running around from time to time saying, gee, my brick amplifier is now going to have 1 dB more gain because they'll replace each of those SO-239 with a type N connector, UG-58. And they assume, because so many people have told them that each UHF connector has got half a dB of loss, and they've gotten rid of the two UHF connectors, and now they're a dB ahead of the game. You believe that, and I'm going to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn that's not too far away from Mel's house. Mr. OES, give me your full call letter, sir, and your name, and proceed with your comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. KC2, OES. Cable Charlie 2, Oscar Echo Sierra. My first name is Fred. I'm in New Jersey. I've been listening for many months now, and I have a question about an antenna for a boat anchor, a receiver, when you have time.
Okay, Fred, you're on the list, and I think you're going to be right after Stan. I think Stan is our last person. Stan, KC2, Baker X-ray uniform. If you're still there, Stan, go right ahead, K2RIW. We took so long getting back to Stan, I think he either fell asleep at the switch or went off and did something more interesting. One last call. KC2BXU, are you there, Stan?
This is KC2 Bravo Yankee Victor. Dan, maybe you mean me?
Okay. Wow. I made a double error here. I thought it was Stan. Maybe it's Dan. And Bravo Victor Uniform BXU. Wow. Did I mix that one up? You got it, Dan.
No problem. Good evening. Let's see. Right now I'm running, I got a full-length G5RV, and I just put up a G5RV Junior. The full length is in a zigzag pattern across the roof, and the junior is nice and straight. But I was thinking I'd like to add to it a somewhat of a vertical antenna. And I was thinking if it would make any sense to you, and what you think the takeoff angle would be, because I'm trying to work a little DX with it. If I were to take about 40 feet of 3/4-inch PVC pipe and put it all together straight up and run a wire through it as a dipole and feed that with coax. Does that make any sense to you? Or maybe a ground plane or something. Do you have any thoughts on that, KC2BYV?
Boy, do I have thoughts on that one, Dan. And we've been discussing, Mel and I and other people have been discussing that quite a few times over the last few weeks. A pure, vertical, real dipole at some reasonable altitude, in my opinion, in Mel's opinion, will almost always outperform a full quarter-wave ground plane with a zillion radials on the ground will outperform it most of the time because the phase center is higher up, because it doesn't require a zillion radials. It's a lot easier to establish a real half-wave, electronically half-wave vertical dipole. It's a fantastic antenna. Very unpopular. People don't believe it. They don't believe such a simple structure could work so well. All of those 30 ground plane radios you should lay down with a quarter wave ground plane are to try to make your backyard look like a sheet of copper so that none of the RF waves sees the dirt, which would act as a dummy load and absorb it and turn it into heat to keep the worms warm in the wintertime, but that's not what you're trying to do with your valuable RF energy. And so when you make your backyard into a sheet of copper, as far as the radio wave is concerned, you're creating a mirror image, and so you have the real quarter wave radiator up top, there is a mirror image of one underneath the ground, and therefore electronically you created a half wave dipole. Why work so darn hard down so low to do that? The best kind of a ground plane is a quarter wave of wire into an open circuit, so to speak, the other quarter wave. So build the whole half wave dipole. Get it up in the air by way of a bow and arrow, a slingshot into a tree, a tower, or your PVC pipe. Fantastic. And even if you have to electronically shorten it by putting top hats at the end, loading coils in the center, and zigzagging it. Still the fact that it's a real electronic half-wave dipole, vertically polarized at whatever altitude you can get. You're going to get a hell of a lot more performance, in my opinion. In a couple of seconds, I'm going to turn it over to Mel, and he's going to give his opinions on this one. Some of the guys at his Kings County Radio Club have run some of these experiments, and I bet you he's got some real anecdotal evidence to back this up. A horizontal dipole gives you a ground reflection that gives you 180-degree phase reversal. Therefore, you always get a kind of a null on the horizon with a horizontal dipole. And the first peak is up above that horizon, depending on how far above the ground the dipole is. A vertical dipole does not suffer 180-degree phase reversal, a vertical signal. So therefore, it's a lot easier to get a very low angle of radiation out of a vertical dipole than a horizontal dipole at the exact same altitude. Just that mechanically, it's a little bit more difficult, but I think it's worth the effort. Mel, what do you think along these lines? K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Oh, yes, I've had a lot of experience in this direction. Dick just said, I have compared, I have a vertical for 80 meters, and I've got quite a number of radios, at least 100 radios, over 6,000 feet of radios that are buried. In comparison, I tried, in comparison, vertical dipoles, and they compare extremely favorable with that type of vertical, even with all the radios. So the bang for your buck is no doubt going to a kind of vertical dipole. In fact, what I even found, I could even enhance the vertical dipole if I went ahead and I slanted it, not perfectly vertical. I have it slanted approximately on an angle of about, with ground, about 62 degrees for listening and working DX stations on especially 40 meters. And the 40-meter dipole with the 62-degree angle at ground level really is an exceptionally good dipole. In fact, as Dick says, it will work better than a quarter wavelength vertical. And even if you get that quarter wave vertical, you're going to have to also get that quarter wave vertical. That the base of it is a minimum of a quarter wave above ground. So that means on 40 meters, you've got to be at least 30 plus feet above ground just to mount the vertical. So simply put, you can't go wrong with the vertical dipole. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, as I see it, it's much easier to get a low angle of radiation for DX purposes with vertical polarization than with horizontal. Your first priority is to get the signal down low, strong, out there. The second priority is to match the polarization. By way of the loop experiment, the small loop antenna that's in the shack with Mel, and he does receiving experiments with it, he has discovered something that seems to be an extremely well-kept secret. We all hear about it from time to time and don't pay attention to it. When the signal on any of the HF frequencies goes through the ionosphere and comes back to Earth, because the ionosphere is a plasma, and that plasma simultaneously has a magnetic field going through it, the Earth's magnetic field, you combine those two things, you get something called Faraday rotation. That signal that's launched by your buddy in London from a horizontally polarized dipole, that signal, when it gets to the ionosphere, gets rotated maybe multiple times before it gets to your house on Long Island or in New Jersey. And so that vertical signal, that horizontal signal that he launched, could easily end up as vertical. And so Mel has discovered that when he's got something that is rotatable in azimuth, elevation, and polarization, just a relatively small wavelength loop in the shack with him, he can peak it up and get some extremely increased signal. So to repeat, your highest priority is to get the signal there. Your second priority is try to match the polarization. It only really gives you a problem when you end up completely cross-polarized. If you had a pure horizontal antenna and the signal getting to you was purely vertical, in theory you would get very little of it. Back to you, Dan. KC2, BVU, T2RIW on the tech deck. My name is Dick.
Welcome to the W2BL repeater.
KC2BYZ. Okay, well, does my construction ideas make sense to you then? Essentially just about 40 feet of pipe with the wire suspended inside, tied on the ends with caps. And I even figured in the middle I put a T and run another piece of pipe out a foot or so to kind of bring the feed line away from it so as not to interfere with the radiation. I think if I do that and put it on a roof, probably about 30 feet up, we'll see how that works. And does this need any kind of counterpoise or just alone, just basically as a dipole on its end, this will work?
A dipole is its own counterpoise, a full dipole. When you launch positive current to the right-hand side of the dipole, you are subtracting negative current, so to speak, from the left-hand side of the dipole. Action and reaction, like Newton's third law. And boy, I mixed up your call letters again. BYU was BYZ. I keep getting it wrong. I'll eventually get there. Hang in there, Dan. But no counterpoise is required for a full half-wave dipole, whether it be horizontal or vertical. And yes, sort of a T-connector and bringing the transmission line off at right angles for a short distance is a good way to go. I recently have done experimenting at microwave frequencies with what's called a bazooka fin dipole. In other words, the transmission line goes up the center of the lower half of the vertically polarized dipole. So if you do some Google searches on bazooka fed, sleeve fed dipoles, you'll find some nice articles on the subject. So if you desire, you could run two or three wires as a cage on the lower half of the dipole with the coax cable going up the center of it, and the real upper half of the dipole is ordinary radiating wire. You could do that, and mechanically it's kind of sophisticated, and as I said, a sleeve-fed or bazooka-fed dipole has some nice advantages. A little bit more bandwidth, folks, believe it or not, and mechanically simpler. But the quickest and dirtiest way, and it's not dirty, the quickest way is the T off to one side, because you do want to separate the transmission line by a couple of feet. If you ran the transmission line thoroughly parallel with the lower half of the dipole, you would be doing some detuning. If you're willing to readjust the length, you can get it back into resonance, but it's a fair amount of rigmarole to do that. Any further questions on this, Dan? Back to you.
No, very good. I figured it made sense to me. I wanted to see what you thought. Let's see if I can get some spare time and try to get it up. I'll let you know how it goes. Thanks for the input. KC2BYZ.
Okay, Dan. After you install that, please come back and let us know how well it worked and whether or not you like it and what changes you made after you first did the installation. Fred is next. K2 Obo Echo Sierra. You got it, Fred. K2RIW on the deck net.
Hi, Dick. It's Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Echo Sierra. My question is in reference to a receiver. It's a tube model RCA AR-8505. It's a 7.2 Super Heptagon. It's from 540 to 30,000 kilocycles. Two-part question. Is it worth my time to put new tubes in it, for one? The other is, because I've discovered that the tubes are 6 out of the 7 tubes are bad. I have a tube checker. My other question is, I'm confused about what kind of antenna. It talks about a doublet. Back to you, Dick.
A doublet is the old-fashioned word for dipole. So doublet and dipole are one and the same, to my knowledge. If not, Mel, who's more into that jazz, is going to correct me on that one. Should you restore a tube-type radio? And that's a function of really what you desire. The problem is a little bit similar to, should I build my own optical telescope? Should I grind my own mirror? And in the case of a telescope, you might really enjoy the process of making that parabolic shape and walking around the barrel and recognizing the physics involved for doing the grinding and getting that exotic shape that does that focusing. And if you enjoy the process, go for it. If your purpose is to look through a telescope and study the sky, you're going to come out way ahead to take a week or two of your wages and buy a telescope, buy a good one. possible. In the case of an older radio, if you enjoy antique radios, and if that particular radio has some characteristic that you enjoy, then go in and restore it. If you want a modern-day, frequency-synthesized, very stable radio with digital signal processing and tunable IF and whatever, and a nice liquid crystal display and so on, then should you restore an old tube radio instead of putting your effort and money into a new one? The answer in that particular case is obvious. Let me give you one other example in my case. When I do work on 432, when back in the days when the Montauk Point radar was in operation, a KC-135, NOAA was it now, FPS-35 was the military nomenclature for that radar. It gave me extremely strong signal pulses, 100 and 120 dB above my threshold into my 432 receiver. It bombed the living daylights out of me. There was one receiver that could survive that, the Drake R4C. It had a FET-type noise blanker mixed into a tube receiver. That receiver had dynamic range that I don't think any other receiver built on planet Earth has ever come close. So if I want a high dynamic range receiver, I am willing to spend the money and the man hours to turn over every leaf on this planet to find those tubes to keep that radio running when I'm doing that particular kind of work. It has a property that I like, even though it is a 30-year-old radio. So does it have a property you like? Is it antique? Do you like antique restoration? So you have to make these kind of decisions. And so an awful lot of it is more personal than Mel and I can answer. So let me turn it back to you there, Fred. KC2, OES. Well, I'm really screwing up the call letters tonight. K2RIW.
No problem. Normally the S on the end becomes an F. That's what usually happens. Well, it's interesting to me. It's something I'm trying to learn how to use, the tune checking machine. You know, it's just a process. It's something I'm going through. I'm looking at it. And I'm saying, you know, it's pretty clean. It's nice. I fired it up. It fires up. It doesn't quite work the way I think it should because all them tubes are bad. And I think that's all that's really wrong with it. And the antenna is another question. You said it was an old-fashioned anchor dipole. That's what I thought, but I wasn't sure. My other question is this. It's open-ended, and there's two, screw-type connectors on the side. Do both of the leads go to those terminals, or is one of them, or am I only using one for the aerial, and the other one goes to ground? Back to you.
Okay. In the case of a doublet antenna, now I'm going to pass it over to Mel really this time for his confirmation on it. The so-called folded dipole fed with twin leads, I think, is the usual embodiment of what was called a doublet. The antenna itself was a half-wave dipole, but fed in the folded dipole manner with twin lead balanced transmission line, not coax cable. So when you got two side-by-side screws, quite possibly that radio was designed to listen to twin leads. See if Mel agrees with all of this. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Well, definitely this is K2KUY. This fell with the radio when you got the radio. It had a 300-ohm wire. The whole antenna, the whole doublet at that time was made with 300 ohms. And it went up to the piece of wire that what you could call the leading line of the feed line. Went up to this antenna. They gave you a number of feet of wire, and then it was split, and then they split a piece of length of 300 ohm wire. At that point, the ends of the 300 ohm wire of the horizontal portion of it were connected together. So that what you did was you hooked the two wires, the two 300 ohm wires, to those two terminals, and that was your antenna system. As far as tubes go, I wouldn't take the tube checker as the gospel that the tubes are all that bad. It's very possible that if you clean that up and take out you want to touch up maybe the alignments of the IF, possibly have, you know, dried up over the years, that you can pick up the performance. You pick up like WWVH, that'll give you a nice steady tone, and you can either on, you know, 2.5, 5, 10, or 15, 20 megahertz. And what you do as you can touch up those IMs very gently, move them a little bit. They shouldn't have to be tweaked very much, but that many times will bring back the performance of the radio. I wouldn't worry so much that the tube check shows all the tubes bad. I doubt that very much. If anything, I would say the most likely the tube that would be bad, that would really deter, the, you know, determine its performance to a great deal, believe it or not, is the rectifier. So I think if this is, was, I don't think this had a power transformer. Let me think. No, it didn't have a power transformer. It was a series 2. So I think the rectifier, and that was a 35-volt rectifier tube, usually took the most beating. So, listen, I have a number of these radios around here that I have restored. One's going back to the 20s even, and they're nice to look at. You know, it's just a conversation piece. I'm not looking to do, you know, effective lot of amateur radio work with them. Even though I do put on the air, every year we do have a thing here we get together called the Straight T Night, S-K-N, which comes up next month in December, runs between December 31st and January 1, and everybody gets on there, uses straight keys on CW, and they also dig out the old relics, and some of the rigs go back to the 30s. So I'm using one from the 50s, a couple of my old radios from the 50s. So there's still hams that really appreciate and love to get on the air with some of the old boat anchors. And if nothing else, if you clean it up and looks good, it's something, you know, like I say, yeah, it's a conversation piece, Dick. This is KTKUY, back to you.
Thank you for that information. Now, with reference to those two lugs that the antenna connects to, you could connect one to ground and one to the center conductor, and it would work. You'll get a little bit more performance if you use it in the differential manner, as if twin lead was there. 20-30 years ago, Fred, the lowest loss transmission line you could buy was 300 ohm twin lead. Nowadays, they've made huge progress in the design of coax cable. Coax cable gives you a lot more performance than twin lead ever did. So therefore, you're more likely going to want to use coax as your transmission line. And then what's the exact way to bring in the cable to your two screws? You could connect the shield to one and the center conductor to the other. It will work. If you built yourself a half-wave coax balance, it would work better. In other words, where the coax cable comes from the antenna, into the shack, you then convert it into a twin lead by building a half-wave coax balance. If you were doing this on, let's say, 40 meters, 20 meters, and on up into VHF, it's relatively easy. At super low frequencies, a half wave of cable is an awful long length. There, you'd probably want to build either an LC circuit or a ferrite-type transformer that converts from unbalanced to balanced. So it's a balancing device we're talking about here. The doublet of old used to use balanced transmission lines. All modern-day coax cables are called unbalanced transmission lines. The outer conductor is considered ground. The center conductor carries the signal. That's why it's considered unbalanced. And if you buy the right kind of a balancing device made for that particular frequency region, install it between those two screws and your cable, you'll get a little bit more performance. And the other advantage you'll pick up is that only the antenna will be sensitive as opposed to the transmission line. If you did the quick and dirty technique of just connecting the center conductor to one screw and the shield to the other screw, you will force the outer conductor of your transmission line to be part of the antenna. And if that transmission line was in an apartment building in Cairnsburg, New Jersey, if there was such a place, if there was an apartment building and the transmission line ran alongside of the elevator motor, which makes lots of noise, you'd be picking up that noise and installing it into your radio. And at these low frequencies, static and noise is something you got to worry about. You'd like the antenna to pick up all the signal and not the transmission line. So with the proper use of a balancing device on both ends, at the doubled antenna end and down at the radio end, you can stop your transmission line from being sensitive to signals along its length, and only the antenna will pick up the signals. So at those lower frequencies, you have to worry about static crashes and ignition transformers and motors for elevators and fluorescent lighting and all these other things that make noise that your transmission line might go past in the worst case situation. Back to you, Fred. KC2 OES, K2LIW on the deck net.
Okay, I'm trying to cram all as much in here as I can. Real quick on the antenna. Basically, it's a piece of twin lead for the antenna. It recommends in the manual to use coax. It was used aboard ship originally, this radio, a Marine Service radio. It was made in 42, goes back to 39, some of the earlier models. It says 60 foot. Now, that's 30 feet to the left, 30 feet to the right, I'm assuming. It says it needs shop equipment to align it. I'd be afraid to do that myself. I've never actually done something like that. So I'm going to use the coax for a lead-in. One more question about fuses. AGU, they're 3/8 diameter by 1.5 inch long. Are they still available? That's my next question.
I know about the so-called 3AG series of fuses. Mel, do any of those numbers ring a bell with you?
3AG, those are the, what he described is a 3AG fuse. They're still available. You can get them. In fact, I think Radio Shack, if I remember correctly, still had them in stock. No problem getting them. I sent one of the guys over. I forgot to pack fuses. And of course, some fuses did blow in a piece of equipment on the last field day. And so he went over to Radio Shack, of course, a couple of 5-amp fuses that come in one of those heat-sealed little containers. So they're available. The fuses, there's no problem to get them over.
Yeah, but I think you had a different model number for the fuse that I'm not quite as familiar with. Back to you, Fred.
Okay, to quote the manual, it says, little fuses, I'm assuming that's the brand, number 5AG, 1-amp, and I referred to everything online I could find, and they could. It's an old name, and they call it an EGU, but it's no longer available in 1-amp. The lowest amperage I was able to find is 30 amps, and that's as far as I've gotten so far.
Yeah, but if you go to Radio Shack and you try to buy 1-ampere fuses, they probably come in 2 or 3 different physical packages. And if you're a little bit mechanically crafty, I'll bet you you'll find a way to adapt it so that it can work in your particular fuse holder. In the worst case, you may have to replace the old fuse holder with a new fuse holder. Radio Shack also sold all kinds of fuse holders. So you could just rewire the radio in such a way that it has a fuse holder supplied by Radio Shack that mates with a 1-ampere fuse supplied by Radio Shack. I wonder if that's the way you would do it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
What he's talking about, that the old fuse, they used to designate them as the fuses were used for mobile, automobile, the old mobile, automobile type fuse. All this kind of stuff. In fact, you mentioned that Valum, that 300 ohm to coax Valum. I've seen many of them, little box sales, so you've got a twin lead on one side and a connector on the other side, sold for 50 cents, I believe. As in fact, I saw them laying on the table at the last time we went to the Hozark. Back, I believe it was around June, there was a whole bunch of those different types of contraptions. And this fuse that he's talking about mostly was surplus, Dick. Those are the surplus World War II vintage fuses. And like you say, the easiest thing to do is to get one of those new fuse holders. It was very common. Again, any of the handsets, you see, always see cables of that stuff like that laying in a junk pile. The fuse holders that will take us like a 3AG fuse pick over.
Yep, sounds like there's many solutions there. So, good luck with that project, Fred. Please come back and tell us how well it worked when you're finished. Back to you, Fred, for any final.
Okay, thank you. I got one more quick thing to touch on. The only tube that I tested that was good was the 6K8 mixer oscillator with ORCA tube. The rectifier tube was also bad, which was the 25C5 rectifier tube.
still think it's worth repairing. I looked them up. They're only about $25, I think, maybe $30 for all the tubes total.
As I see it, Fred, for a man of your resources, if you love that radio, or you love what it could do, if you like its physical styling, it's a bit of an antique. If you appreciate antiques, if it's an easy way to tune that particular frequency range and do an experiment, a $25 investment to me is small. That's to the average person, I guess it's around an hour's labor or something like that if you're in the technical field. One of the things that I see from time to time is that ham radio operators sometimes become real penny pinchers. And you know what they say, you can't take it with you. The way you win the game is to die with the most number of toys. When it comes to good test equipment, when it comes to good tools, I don't quibble. I just say, I'm worth it, and I go buy it. And thank goodness the current wife number one, tolerates that. And I know that some people live with a lady who thinks a little bit more frugally. And she says, why are you doing this hobby, and why are you putting money into it? $25 to me is not a lot. If I loved that radio, I would go do it. Back to you, Fred.
Okay, that pretty much answers all the questions. I guess I'll just get to building my antenna, and when the time is right, I know where to get the tubes. They're not hard to find. And I'll go ahead and do that. Thank you very much for your time. I have lots more, but I'll keep it for another time. KC2OES, clear and listening.
Pretty fine, Fred. Mel and I have what we think is one hell of a track record. You're listening to Technical Net number 1161 that began in September of 1982. We're here every single Sunday. There's 52 weeks in the year, and we're here about 50 or 49 of those Sundays per year. So come on back, and unless something terrible happens, most likely we'll be here. We've got a track record. Okay, the next person, I think we should go over to Paul, because he's a working man. He's not like us retired people, and we don't want to keep him up too late. And as I said to you earlier, Paul, of the nicest comments we get about the TechNet, there are people who say, boy, I like hearing what NASA is doing. I like hearing about space and the astronauts. And by the way, this last week, I saw an extremely good PBS program on the Huygens probe and the Cassini satellite. Boy, very nicely done. And I hope they repeat that a zillion times. I sat there and said, I want to watch that show again. I want to watch what those people did. That was a 12,000-pound satellite that they launched out there. It had a 2 billion-mile journey to encounter Saturn. It dropped this probe down into the only other heavenly body in this particular solar system we know of that we think is capable of supporting biological life, and that is the moon Titan that's going around that beautiful planet Saturn. And as they discovered the ring, as they studied the rings of Saturn, they discovered that the rings are only a couple of hundred feet thick, even though there are many thousands of miles of width to those rings. Very thin rings, very thin material, and it's ice crystals. And the ice crystals on the outer perimeter of the Saturn's rings are almost pure water ice, whereas the inner portions of the rings are contaminated. So from that, they figured out that the inner portion of the rings are much older, the outer portions are much younger, and something is creating more and more ring material out at the perimeter. That was some of what was brought out, among many other things, in that program. I hope you had a chance to see it. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, WS2N. Oh, yeah, I saw it. I recorded it. This way, anytime PBS runs a show like that, I'll record it, because sometimes they'll say something or I'm interrupted. You have to go back and rewind that. What did they say, And that was very beautifully done. PBS has excellent shows, and that was one of the better ones. And that was the first time I really saw that they confirmed that they do have methane rain on Titan. you know, that was theorized before it even landed, and I heard after it landed, maybe it does, and maybe it's got puddles here and methane, but that confirmed it all. So that was very good. And you had a spectrometer on board Cassini. Even so, Huygens had landed, and they spent, 100 hours of transmission data up to Cassini using that as a repeater. The information is still being picked up every time Cassini passes Titan. That's going to be on many extended missions, that Cassini mission, just like Galileo was with Jupiter there. So yeah, good show. They'll repeat that. A lot of those shows come back. Or you could look for Channel 21. Sometimes it'll come on that as well, Dick. So get your tape recorder out and record it. Dick, I wanted to mention STS-120 Discovery is back after a very successful mission putting the Harmony node module into place. That will be able to pick up a lot more modules in the future. They had node 1 up there, node 2. And it's really another gigantic room is really what it adds living space, although its main purpose is to connect other modules in the future and docking ports. So they also put that S6 solar panel on, Dick. And Dick, did anybody write in an email that I said that there was 4 sets of panels when I wanted to say there were 3? Did you get that in your email? Back to you, Dick. Turn it back to me. I'll elaborate a little bit on that.
Nope, we didn't get any flack on that one. And so you got away with that one, Paul. Go ahead.
I got ahead of myself. I realized afterwards, you know, that was the P6. They never put the S6 segment up there. That's scheduled to go up in November of 2008, next year. But there are 3 sets of panels now up there. So I wanted to correct that. And Atlantis is now ready for launch. It's out on the launch pad. Discovery landed in Florida. That saves many millions of dollars when they do that, instead of getting it transported from California on the 747. So that's back. That'll get set up for an April flight, but Atlantis is on the launch pad, presently being loaded at the launch pad. They open up the doors and they put in the payload, and in this case it's the Columbus module. It's another very big module, bigger than the last one that they brought up, but this is a working lab built by the European Space Agency. It will be attached to the Harmony node when they get up there, the one that they just brought up. And then they'll have 3 main rooms up there. The original Russian Zarya room, working area / lab, but the main lab is the Destiny lab by the U.S. That's been up there quite a while now. Now you're going to have a European Space Agency lab bolted to the Harmony node in December 6th, for that flight. And then early next year, you're going to have another module similar size being put up, built by the Japanese, called Kaibo, K-I-B-O. I think that's pronounced that way. And that's going to be also attached to the Harmony node. That's an interesting module. It's really it takes 2 flights to get that up, to bring that up, and then there's another gigantic platform, a gigantic floating patio, you might call it, that attaches to that. And any experiments that will be done outside in vacuum, many experiments that are being on, done on board, of course, are, you know, indoors, inside the labs. Any experiments that they want to be done outside, crystal growth or whatever they're going to do, will be done outside on this gigantic pallet patio type of arrangement that's going to be attached to this Japanese lab. And once that's put on, they're going to have their own robotic arm. And in this lab, they're also going to have an airlock. Not really for people, but for the equipment. They'll put the equipment inside the airlock, be able to take the robotic arm, remove the equipment, put it out on the ledge, you might say, and then bring other ones back in, and this way they don't have spacewalks, no problem, in doing that process. And then there's quite a few assembly missions that will be going up. The whole kit and caboodle should be done by 2010, and then there's a long wait for future flights by Americans. The Russians will be going up there left and right with their Soyuz spacecraft. They'll be increasing their flights. We're bringing people up. Progress rockets will be going up, supplying equipment, taking back our debris and waste. And that'll be going on for 4 years, from 2010 to 2014. That'll be the next time the Americans, we send up a craft, the Orion, the newly built Orion spacecraft. And that will, actually the first one's just going to go up and rendezvous around it, not even dock, according to what I've read. And then the next one after that, again in 2014, will actually dock. And that will be a system for us bringing people and supplies to the space station instead of the space shuttle from 2014 and beyond. And some of those missions will actually be unmanned, and we'll be duplicating what the Progress missions do today by the Russians. So I guess that's it for now, Dick, unless you want to talk about Cassini a little bit more or any other space topic. K2RIW, WS2M.
Yeah, let me advise to anybody who looks at the TV guide and finds out that the Cassini project as a NOVA, I believe it was a NOVA program, is shown again. You want to see it. If you have any interest in space and technology and satellites and remote robotic devices, making all these fantastic measurements by which we're finding out more and more about how this solar system was formed, what are its properties, how long has it been here, where is it going, is there life, and so on. By the way, my ASTLI listserv, Astronomical Society of Long Island, brought to my attention that they're finding more and more closely Earth-like planets going around other stars. They discovered a star, which I think it was like 20 or so light years away from us, which has, I believe they've discovered, five separate planets going around that particular star, detecting some of the smaller planets. Earth is a small planet. To detect a small planet going around a star is very difficult by comparison to detecting a Jupiter, because it creates a whole lot of blockage of the star's light when the planet goes between you and the star, or because it creates a wobble in the star, and you look at the Doppler shift of the emission lines of the star itself, very similar to the emission lines of the sun, for instance. Now, I'm going to hit you with an unfair question, Paul. You haven't had preparation for this one, but occasionally I'll run into a critic who will say, yeah, the space stuff is nice, and those remote piloted vehicles and those spacecraft, the robotic vehicles are real nice. But we're putting a very large amount of money into the International Space Station. We're making a lot of progress. We're learning a lot about technology. But is there an easy way of saying what will be the benefit of the space station? Obviously, it takes some more time to figure out, and I'm sure NASA has a website that explains this. But if someone asks you that question, what is the major benefit for which the space station is being created, the International Space Station. I know that the zero gravity allows you to do certain metallurgical experiments, make very high strength materials, and also allows you to do certain biological experiments. The microgravity situation is one of the main benefits as I see it, which allows you for a very long period of time while fabricating either pharmaceuticals or fabricating certain high-strength metals and maybe things like nanotubes and whatever, but there's certain kinds of research that can be done in microgravity that can't be done anywhere else. And I think that that's one of the major benefits that will come out of the International Space Station. I'll bet you there's a whole lot more. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, technically, engineering-wise and all, you know, we learned so much by putting this behemoth up there. That's really the name of the game now. I mean, there are fine things being done now, you know, in the Destiny lab, especially. But in the future, when everything is completely done, when the Columbus module's up, the Kaibo module's up, all the experiments are going, you know, you're going to have mainly medical, I would say, is probably number one. And starting with that, of course, the NASA's benefit would be long-term duration spaceflight. How is it going to affect everybody? All right, the Mars missions, they're looking for that to the future. Not the near future, but in the future. They would like to know, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to really need to have artificial gravity, or are we going to develop chemicals and pills and something that we could do for these people so they don't lose, I think it was at 3% of their bone loss for every 5 months up there or something like that. You lose bone loss, you could wind up with osteoporosis, all these problems could develop. Now, you can't have that when you land on Mars. You got to be in good shape. So are they going to develop medicines to help that? And of course, by doing that, looking long term, you might develop drugs for people with osteoporosis. Big problem here on Earth. Maybe arthritis could be worked on because of the experiments that they do. So there's a lot of things that in the medical field, cardiovascular problems, blood flow. You know, your blood rises up in your body when you're in space. You know, could that happen to people when they're bedridden for months or years on end? You know, what could you do for these people? Maybe there's physical things that they could do to help them, or maybe there's medications that will be developed to control that kind of a problem with people. Long-duration moon flights, you know, you're going to send up people not for weeks, maybe for months, maybe even for years on moon bases. On a moon base, you weigh one-sixth the gravity of that we hear, you know, right here on Earth. So, you know, you're going to have a low gravity field there. That could create a similar problem to a long Mars flight. You're going to need to be able to have that under control. So medical, I would say, is probably number one. All your crystals that they've tried to grow for years, I really haven't heard much success on that, but maybe there's future development on that. Testing of things that need to be in pure vacuum, colder environments, like on the outside of a Kibo or a lab, might help. With superconductivity, you know, you different materials, it'd be easy to test things up in space than maybe on Earth. Who knows what, Dick, what comes out of this type of thing. And of course, it is a stepping stone for maybe going on to to the moon and then on to Mars, you know, you're going to eventually bring stuff back from Mars. Even unmanned flights are going to come back from Mars with materials on it. You want to bring those materials directly to Earth, they might send it to the space station first. Check it out up there before you so-called contaminate the Earth with something. I don't know, Dick. There's so much that could be done with this. Things that we haven't thought of. Just like when we originally had the original Apollo mission, you know, going to the moon. You know, so much came off of that. Maybe it would have been developed. It sure hastened the pace of development, I would think. It's probably a big plus. Back to you, WS2M.
Yeah, Apollo is an extremely good example. A person who wants to be highly critical will look at the Apollo program and said, yeah, we spent $33 billion. We got into a space race with the Soviet Union. And the bottom line is that we brought home a certain number of pounds of lunar soil. If you want to be super critical, you could say that. In reality, in the process of accomplishing that goal, we developed a Saturn V booster. We developed a greatly advanced computer technology, a kind of celestial navigation, high temperature materials, ceramics for heat shields, fancy ways of increasing the efficiency of power converters and solar cells, communication equipment that drastically increased the ability to put up very good synchronous satellites. I believe there were no synchronous satellites. Yes, there were. There were communication satellites in orbit. I don't know if there were any synchronous satellites before the Apollo program. But right now, we all take for granted what weather sites satellites are giving us, what SOHO is telling us, the solar heliographic satellite that allows you to take a look at what the sun is doing and giving you advance warning when a solar storm is about to bombard the Earth with a whole lot of particles that are going to do terrible things to the ionosphere and disrupt the power supplies, your long-range transmission grids for Canadian Hydro, for instance. You'd like to have some forewarning when Sol is about to lean on us, if you know what I mean. If you've got astronauts out in space, you'd like to know ahead of time that the particles are on the way. And SOHO tells you that. So the apparent goal of Apollo was to meet the Russians, land on the moon first, pick up some lunar soil, and study it, bring it back home. That was the apparent goal. But the side effects of achieving that goal far outweigh what the goal resulted in, so to speak. The fallout, I guess is the right word for it. The fallout far exceeded. End analysis and economic analysis has been done, which I believe said for each dollar you spend on space with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, creates more than $5 of flow in the American economy. I think the ratio was 5-1. There's a slim chance I've got it wrong and it's 25-1, but I think it's 5-1. I wonder if you've heard of anything similar to that kind of a quote, economic quote, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Since the 1970s, I would say I remember hearing 6-1, and that's stuck in my head all these years, and I've heard that many times. So 5-1 is reasonable. 25-1, I might be out there. You know, you look at 400,000 people were working to put Mercury and Gemini and Apollo into Skylab into space. And, you know, it just it was phenomenal. And the momentum afterwards, you know, that went on. We created a situation where they sent Viking to Mars. These are all your interplanetary missions wouldn't be taking place now. So, you know, what you really learned from the space race is that, you know, what's on these moons and on Titan, and what's out there at the heliopause.